Hello, and welcome to the Season 2 premiere of Dice Exploder. Each week, we take a tabletop RPG mechanic and throw graph paper at it to see if that helps. My name is Sam Dunewald, and welcome back! This is actually the first of a two-part season premiere. I'm releasing a second episode tomorrow that kind of pairs with this one. You'll see. My host today, though, is Clayton Notestein. Clayton is the RPG graphic design guy. He's known for his Twitter threads breaking down the visuals of games, but the thing he's best known for is Explorer's Design, a blog and community built around RPG visual design. He's got posts that teach the basics, a friendly Discord for talking about and experimenting with all things layout, and even the Explorer's template for Affinity and Adobe InDesign, which is not just a template built for quickly laying out classic fantasy games and modules, but its example text is itself instructions on how to do it and pick it apart. It's so slick. Something I'm excited to explore more of on this season is visual design and vibes as mechanics. So I knew right away I wanted Clayton on the show, but when I invited him, he wanted to bring something even more basic than any of that, the hexagon. I promised in the season one trailer that Dice Exploder was going to be a nuts and bolts show, and let me tell you, there's not much more nuts and bolts than grade school geometry. This is a technical episode, if ever there was one. Clayton tells some fun stories about the early days of RPGs, we get lost in some wonderful number theory minutia, and then we get to mechanics for logistics-based travel in RPGs and hex-based maps at large. And I wanted to say one last thing before we get started. There's a completely different side to RPG travel, the story game side that skips the logistics to try and capture the emotional truth of travel. Clayton and I don't really talk about that in this episode, but there's two other episodes coming up this season that get into all of those feelings. So if you're pumped about hexes, I hope you stick around for those. And if you're more of like a For the Queen junkie, I hope you give this episode a shot and see how the other half lives. But let's set all that aside for now, because this episode is brought to you by the number 6. Here is Clayton Notestein with the hex. Clayton, thanks so much for being here.
Sorry, I have my brain already froze up. I have this problem every time with a podcast where I want to start, and then I just get stage fright, even though it's just one person in the chat.
You're not the only person like that.
A skill that needs to be practiced and learned.
Well, we'll leave all that in. And,
excellent. Love that. Yeah. Hope it makes me relatable.
Exactly. So what are we talking about today?
We are going to talk about the hex grid, more specifically, the hex. A regular hexagon, when arranged together, creates a matrices, and that makes a map.
I love hexagons. I love shapes.
Oh.
Big math guy. Love the geometry.
Absolutely.
Let's do it. So this isn't from like a specific game, like in my mind. Like I feel like when I think about hexagons, I think about like Settlers of Catan, right? Which is, in some ways, we're going to kind of get into related ideas here. But the concept of what game is the hex from is more sort of the oral tradition of playing role-playing games, I feel like. You want to get into that a little bit? Like, tell me about where did this thing come from?
Oh, for sure. So I think the important thing to know is that like hexagons and the hex maps existed before RPGs ever did. So
hexagons go back pretty far, I hear.
Yeah. I think the earth and something about basalt or rocks invented the hexagon.
Yeah.
But when we think about like RPGs and how they started using hexagons, I think a lot of people talk about Advanced Dungeons and Dragons or just D&D in general. And to be fair, that has always been the case, even in wargaming. So it's like one of the things that they got. You know, they took like many different parts of the lineage of the hobby comes from wargaming, and the hex grid is one of them. But one of the things I always thought was really funny about D&D is that we kind of think of the overland map, the traveling, as being like this thing that was baked into Dungeons and Dragons as a system. And that just simply isn't the case. Dungeons and Dragons is not really designed, at least not the original.
Yeah.
It was a cobbled together mass made by an actuarian in Wisconsin, and people would ask him questions, and I think he would get frustrated and be like, well, this is how it's going to work, and would have to, you know, essentially make an idea up on the fly.
Yeah.
And so Dungeons and Dragons, I think the first sort of recorded use of the hex map was actually using a completely different game. And this is like a huge thing that happened in Dungeons and Dragons in the past. They used to take other things and then sort of retrofit them for gameplay. That was the same thing with the dice. And in the case of the Hex Map, they would encourage players to go to the hobby store and buy a game from a completely different company called Avalon Hills Outdoor Survival Game.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of Avalon Hills.
Yeah. So this is how you know that it's also wargaming related, because Avalon Hill is like the kind of company where you would go and it would be really ugly box art. And it would just have like a bunch of like cardboard chits inside of it.
Yeah.
And it would usually be about like panzers or like Napoleonic Wars or something like that. And they had this game called, you know, Outdoor Survival. And that was the original hex map that they would use for fantasy exploration in Dungeons and Dragons.
Wow.
Yeah, so really weird.
So honestly, like, feels very modern too. Like, we're still doing that all the time.
Oh yeah.
Like, that's just how I'm playing any dungeon crawler. I'm just going and ripping someone else's dungeon and putting whatever rules I want to it.
It's one of my favorite things to like tell new players who are like, they show that interest where they're like, ooh, yeah, I kind of wonder how this hobby came about. And I'm like, oh, you're not ready for this. Because the same thing is with the dice. Like, the 20-sided die in the past, you couldn't buy one. You had to go to a educational store and they would have mathematical like polyhedrons. And you would buy one and then you would take a crayon and you would draw the numbers onto the die. And this is the 70s, so it's like made out of cheap plastic, so it would turn into a ball after like three sessions, and you have to go back and buy another one.
Yeah. God, really a boost for the educational supply stores economy, for sure.
I know, and we really need to go back to that. We need to go back to that.
So before the Hex Grid, because there obviously was a time before the Hex Grid, like, what were people using for their depiction of overland travel in RPGs or war games?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you said war games, because fundamentally, even to this day, a lot of war games are played with a little piece of string or like a ruler, right? Like, you build up a space in a sandbox or whatever construction you have, and then you would use straight lines and measurements. And this goes back to like Napoleon, right? This is one of my things that I think is funny about war games, is that like, they've been played for centuries. And it's only recently that it's become like purely recreational. And I love like how, if we go even further back, we'll find that like board games and even RPGs have been just like a thing in like human history. I'm going on a tangent here, but I love that, like, for instance, when they opened King Tut's tomb, they found like board games among his things. And, you know, they're packing this tomb with lots of stuff, but there's still limited space. So he picked and chose what he wanted to have in the afterlife with him. And he decided that he needed like a dozen different board games in the afterlife. So,
well, otherwise you're going to be bored. What else are you going to spend your time on?
I mean, he's got, you know, the figurines and everything else that would create an entire help staff for him.
Yeah.
But yeah, I suppose board games would be important. And this is like,
listen, you need the staff to be there so you can play board games with someone. Like, that's the whole point. What are you going to serve up, like solitaire? Fuck that. Like,
yeah, it's boring. You know, I didn't even think about that part.
Yeah.
And then, you know, there's this historical thing of like, oh, yeah, Napoleon was like a great tactician. And it's like, he's just playing the game diplomacy, like on his time off. Of course, he's good at tactical stuff. He's never in front of the cannons. He's always behind it in a tent playing board games.
Yeah.
So, yeah, before there were like traditional RPGs, a lot of war games are just games in general were using just the spatial space. They weren't changing the medium that they were playing on to depict distances. And then slowly over time, these games that would eventually inform the design of role-playing games started having these demarcations and maps, because it was a crucial part of how the game was played. So one of the things I think that's really interesting is like, maps haven't always had distances attached to them. And so nowadays, when we think of like a map, it has to have a ruler or some sort of distance marker on it. And we expect, as modern people, that the distances are going to be exact. But back then, you know, way back in the day, it's like maps were relative. the distance that they were drawing on the map were oftentimes just how long or wide or far away does it feel like it is?
Yeah.
Right?
They're making point crawl maps.
Yeah, exactly. They're making essentially point crawl maps. And I'm not saying that this is like all of them, because
they
were doing star charts and stuff since, you know, ancient times. But if you look at some really weird maps that came out of like the Renaissance or even pre-Renaissance, they would just have like locations on a map, and it would just be sort of in a collage of just like pictures and images and cartoons. It was essentially like a bunch of gag comics and like illustrations just wedged up together into this weird mass. And they'd be like, this is a map. This is Sussex. Yeah. This is Cambridge. Yeah. This is what you need to know about these places. And only when technology really caught up to it, suddenly now it's like we have this expectation that maps are going to be literal translations of the thing that they are depicting.
Yeah.
And the hex map is probably one of the great examples of that. There's all kinds of different maps now. We got, you know, cadastral maps, topographic maps, and navigational maps. And then we have these sort of more like mathematical architectural maps. And the hex grid is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what the central tension is in RPGs is figuring out, is distance important? So like if you're going to use a hex grid, the answer should be probably yes. Distance needs to matter for you to use a hex grid. Because if distance doesn't matter, then you're not using half of what the hex is offering.
Yeah, you don't need the tool. Like the tool is for measuring distance, basically.
Yeah, and if you don't need that, then use a point crawl. You know, point crawls are really cool anyway. So like I prefer in many games having a point crawl over like a hex. But if distance is something you care about, then the next thing you have to do is you have to reconcile or find a balance between having some of those components of the other style of map. Because in real life, distances are inherently useful, and you don't need there to be a cool thing on mile 3 of a map of, say, Ohio. You know, like it can just have empty space. But when you're making an RPG map, you should have some things in spots periodically in order to keep the exploration interesting, because the players need that thrust that sends them over multiple different hexes on the other side of the map.
Yeah. So I'm curious. Do you know why the hex grid really became the thing as opposed to like the square grid?
Yeah, the problem with the square grid is that the shape is just, it's built, it's a weird shape actually when you think about a map. It does give you the like classic cardinal directions of north, south, east, west, but diagonal movement is so much further. There's not an equidistant distance from the center of the square. So you get these really weird movement patterns on a square grid. It became this thing that, like D&D 3rd edition, would constantly hem and haw and like wah and whinge over. It's like, how do we make this work when the players realize that they can just diagonally move like a bishop in chess everywhere, and they'll go farther and faster than if they did the other way?
Yeah, and anyone who's tried to like put a breath weapon onto a square battle map understands the problem here. Like, forget about it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a complete mess. So now I think the hex grid is kind of the one that most people prefer for that reason. And I do see every now and then like game systems will return to the square. I will admit the square is fantastic for drawing maps because I love a good straight line. But when it comes to like exploration, which I think is the big deal with the hex map feels good when it comes to like overland travel through like nation states and countries and terrain. The hexagon is the way to go.
Well, it just feels, when you look at a hexagon just visually, it feels like you are surrounded, as opposed to when you're on a square, it feels like obvious exits are north, south, east, and west. It doesn't feel like you're sort of there. Like something about the difference between just the way they look visually and the numbers 4 and 6 feels really different. It doesn't feel like you can get lost on a grid because it feels so orderly.
Yeah, and that sort of equidistant thing that's happening where like you can picture yourself in the center of the hex. That plus like the number of sides creates a sort of like psychology built into the hex itself, which then leads into expectations or modes of play that don't necessarily exist in the square.
Yeah, so say more about that.
Yeah, so there's a psychology with numbers that I think this is a bonus conversation. But numbers have a psychology sort of built into them that come with presupposed logic behind how you should perceive them and how you should use them. For example, let's just picture ourselves in a room in a dungeon, and there's just one door in front of us. The number one tells you that it matters. It's the monumental thing. You put two doors in front of someone, and they suddenly start to think to themselves, whatever's behind these doors is going to be opposites of each other. It's a choice. And the choice creates in itself an inherent assumption that the two things are going to be opposed. Then you put three, and three things are somehow equal to each other and important in a way where they are interrelated.
It feels balanced. It feels complete. It feels like a whole.
Yeah. Three still feels like you're making a choice, but there's a sort of inherent importance to these three choices. Mm-hmm. As soon as you get into four and five and six, now it's like, oh, this is a menu I'm pulling from.
Yeah.
And what's cool about the hex is it's a six-sided object. So it gives you six different options, which tells the person who is looking at the map that these six directions are both equal and could have anything behind them. And I think that is part of the magic of like picking six too, because there's this whole like rule in like design and UX specifically called Miller's Law. And the whole idea of Miller's Law says that like the average human being can only hold and process about seven plus or minus two things in their working memory.
Yeah.
So if you're going to design like a room or an RPG, so like rules or something, try to keep the number below six. And I think the hex is one of those where it's like six is probably just enough of directions that you can go in before it becomes unwieldy or starts to feel a little arbitrary.
Yeah. Six is also, I think, a good number because when you think about actually practical use at the table, it's very rare that you're sort of like dumped into a hex without any context around it. Like you're coming in from the south, say.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
When you do that, you know, you already know about the hex to the south because you were there. And you know probably a little bit about the two hexes that are neighbors of both the hex that you came from and the hex that you've just come to. You were considering those last time you decided what direction to move. But then you come up and there's three more hexes that are entirely new. And so I think you end up in this really nice place of having some information about part of the surrounding hexes and also no information about some of them. And that balance of like, we've got something to work with, but we also have something new. Like you get the fun of novelty while also retaining enough context that you're not completely at sea.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that I think about a lot, maybe too much, this is a designer who loves shapes problem, but I really like thinking about the orientation of the hex on a hex map. And I haven't I haven't seen a lot of exploration from designers in the RPG space. So this is an invitation to anyone who's listening. But how you orient the hex is going to change the psychology of kind of what your game is about. Or at the very least, it can reinforce what the game is about.
Yeah.
So what I mean by that is like, so if you imagine a six-sided hex, you have to make a choice. And there's generally two like presumed choices. Either you make the flat edge go north-south, or you make the flat edge go east-west. And then when you do that orientation, it creates this thing where like your players will never be able to go pure north, or they'll never be able to go pure south. And what I like about this is if you create a setting, let's go ahead and just use one that already exists. Let's talk about Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones is all about armies marching north and south. There's a tension to the north and south. Mm-hmm. And if we were going to put that entire Westeros onto a hex map, we get to choose what the orientation is going to be. If we were to orient it so that you could go purely north and purely south, then armies could just march directly north or directly south. And then that would say something about how movement works in it. It would almost feel too easy to move north and south because you could go directly north or directly south on the map. If you watch Game of Thrones or you read the books, it's not about going directly north or south.
Yeah.
It's about zigzagging your way up the continent. And all these characters who are in armies or they're, you know, in caravans or they're sneaking or what have you, they are bouncing like pinballs off different settlements across the continent. So if you want to reinforce that in the exploration of your characters, orient that hex so that they can't go directly north or directly south. And now suddenly they're exploring more of the nodes of interest on your map.
Yeah.
Your next favorite game is on My First Dungeon.
Hello and welcome to My First Dungeon.
Hello and welcome to My First Dungeon.
Ho, 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 and welcome to My First Dungeon.
From Sad Space Cowboys.
Kamari takes out a lighter from their pocket and goes, this bar's next.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Let's go.
To death metal Viking cats.
Hello Kitty, you see Melody Tuffington flying through the air, jacked as shit, massive legs, to horny snowmen?
The sad part is that Joshua never gave Frosty a penis.
No.
And everything in between.
It was a dark and stormy night.
We've got something for everyone.
You're a special Gertrude girl in a special Gertrude world. Happy birthday, happy birthday. I'm not a skeleton.
Learn the game, then hear it in action.
That's Snake Eyes minus two. That's a zero.
Snake Eyes, that means that we have our very first plot twist. Anytime somebody rolls doubles, we get a plot twist.
So grab some headphones.
And get lost in a story with us.
I'll be honest, I don't know all the rules of it. We'll kind of figure that out as we go. But do you want to just play? I've got some great stories to tell you.
And remember,
if you're having fun, you're already doing it right.
Oh, fuck.
So something we've kind of alluded to already, but that I think of as really the biggest strength of the hex as a mechanic in hex crawls is the modular nature of it and how that modular nature of it makes it easy to use as a GM. Like when you turn a map into a bunch of hexes, when you break it up into chunks like that, suddenly you do not need to look at an entire continent and figure out how to fill it with interesting stuff. You just take a hex and you deal with that hex and then you move on to the next hex. And that's really nice and useful as a planner, as a GMer, as someone who's prepping. But it's also really useful to make interesting gameplay where as players, you're moving not all the way from here to the castle over there, unless we're, you know, doing a point crawl. Sure, maybe we don't care about the travel. Maybe we're not interested in that game. But if we are interested in that travel and the difficulty of that travel, suddenly the hex means there's a unit of distance and or time that we can use to break down, hey, does something interesting happen? Do we encounter a random encounter? How many resources do we need to use to get from where we are to over there? And the concept of breaking down a map into modular units is the thing that allows all of that to exist.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I want to go back to the outdoor survival game because not only did you use the map when you played like Advanced Dungeons and Dragons using that game, you would also oftentimes use the rules from that game. And in that game, the requirement, I believe, for you to move from like one hex into another hex is that every movement had a cost attached to it.
Yeah.
I believe it was you essentially had like a quota of like how much movement you could do in a turn or in a day. And then that number would go down based off of like what your health was and how many resources you had and like food and water. So one of the things that I, you know, it's thinking about what kind of games lean in that direction because the modular quality is useful to like all games.
Yeah.
Being able to like break something off into pieces and then tackle it one piece at a time is invaluable just as a creative process.
Yeah. Whether it's hexes or like firebrand scenes, right?
But that element of, as you said earlier, of like, oh, well, if it's not important, then you just, you know, snap the fingers, you're now there. And that's like, well, why would we bother ourselves or busy ourselves with the space between that we don't know what's in it. That is an ideology that belongs to a lot of fiction for story games, right? Like, we got a genre to emulate. The miles that the monster hunters are driving in their sedan does not matter. We are going to cut to the important part. But then if you look at the other games that are like, say, that like more old school, and they're about travel, they're about terrain, they're Lord of the Rings or what have you, then suddenly it's, you know, part of the ideology of those games is you're playing to find out what is in the empty space. Like, that's kind of the whole point of it.
Well, and dealing with a logistical problem is interesting, right? Like, I often describe, and I don't play a lot of OSR games, so this is probably completely blasphemy to some people who do, but I often describe the difference between OSR gaming and story gaming as, like, story gaming is kind of genre emulation, like more leaning into the storytelling, and OSR gaming is closer to, like, doing an escape room where there's a lot of fun to be had in solving puzzles, in, like, dealing with logistical problems.
Oh, yeah.
Some people aren't going to enjoy that, right? And those games aren't for them. But the idea that, okay, there's a castle over there and we need to go fight the dragon in the castle or whatever, but how do we get to the castle? Like, that is an interesting question. And the way the community has found to make an interesting game out of answering that question has a lot to do with the modularity of the hex.
Yeah, and again, it goes into that thing of, like, you already, because of the shape of the hex, they have to make choices, but now you get to, like, really weigh those choices, make them heavier and harder to make. When I think of, like, a fantasy game, like your classic fantasy RPG where it's like, oh, we're knights and we're on horses or whatever, it's like, oh, well, we could go through this mountain pass, which is the most direct route. But it's dangerous. Or we could veer off 45 degree angle, go through the other hex, and suddenly we'll take this hidden path into Mordor, essentially.
I
love it. I think problem solving, like, I've heard a lot of people describe OSR as story emergent, but I'm with you in the sense that, like, one, that is true. It is an emergent storytelling, but that's also kind of true for all role-playing games.
Yeah.
The thing that I've noticed more, or at least that I've glommed onto as an individual, is the problem solving portion. And this is how, like, I was just talking to someone recently. We were playing Mothership. It's like, oh, that's how I know Mothership is, like, an OSR-esque game.
Yeah, totally.
Because we're only problem solving in this game constantly. Yeah. We're always trying to figure out how to do something logistically.
To tie together the two ideas, like, the way a friend of mine, John Breckenridge, described OSR gaming to me and its story emergent sort of play is that in story games, you're trying to work with your friends to, like, create a Star War, right? You're trying to make a Game of Throne. You're using a set of rules and procedures to emulate a story like that or tell a unique story like that. And that's really cool. That's great. We love that. But that OSR games are often, instead of, we're doing a Star War, it's like, hey, so, you know, Clayton and I were, like, hanging out at the bar and, like, you wouldn't believe this, like, silly thing that he did. Like, this guy said this thing. It's like you're telling a story about real life. Like, the emergent story is almost describing what you were doing at the table rather than in the canon of the world. And I think that's a really interesting and useful distinction. And I think that a lot of those kinds of emergent stories, to use that, I think, bad vocabulary term, but from the OSR, are stories that come out of creative or failed ways of solving problems. That experience of problem solving is how you get to the kind of storytelling that OSR does.
Yeah, every time I played an OSR game, there is at least one instance that I have deep in my memory. It has created a groove in my head, like my brain, of me just, like, looking at the other players being like, I can't believe this is happening. That doesn't happen.
That
doesn't happen in a lot of story games. Story games, I'm kind of, like, in the fiction, you know. There's a whole conversation about whether or not immersion is possible. I do think it is possible. But when I'm in an OSR, I very much feel much more like I'm a guy pushing a figurine around. Essentially, but that doesn't make it bad. I actually really like both. You know,
Totally. Yeah. And like, because in the story game experience, I've had the experience of ending a session and looking around at everyone and saying, I can't believe that just happened. But like in the moment, I'm more reacting as my character, like, ah, fuck, like this person like is fucking me over right now. How am I going to deal with it? Like, I got to respond where, yeah, totally. It does feel a little bit more past tense when you are experiencing it as yourself.
Yeah. I mean, when I think of stories where I played like, you know, Mothership or Into the Odd or something like that, a lot more of those stories are oriented around I was a player doing a player like thing with my little guy or tools, which makes me think about a completely different thing of like, how physical does the game feel? And I think hexes do this thing where they suddenly make the game like super physical feeling. Like
tactile, for sure.
Tactile, that's it. That's the word to use, tactile. And, you know, you see this in other games, and maybe we're stumbling onto something here. A lot of games that have hex maps often have another tactile component attached to the game in some way.
Yeah.
Like you think of Mouse Ritter, it's like you got the hex map, and then you have little tokens of your inventory that you have to move around like Tetris blocks.
Yeah. Like
it's physical. And then when you think of like Dungeon Crawl Classics, well, they've just increased the number of dice by like 3 times. So like there's a tactile portion to it. It feels in some ways, you know, when I'm playing like a story game, the table might as well not exist. We could be sitting in chairs or on a couch playing the game half the time. But when I'm playing a game that has like a hex map on it or something, we're working on a drafting table. You know, we practically have the X-Acto knives and like rulers and string and everything on standby because the game feels so much more physical.
Yeah.
And now I'm starting to wonder like, how much might you bring in a hex map just to bring some of that physicality? If that's something that you're going for, right?
Yeah.
I think about Forbidden Lands. One of the big selling features of that is that it has a map and you literally lay out the map and put stickers on the hexes that have points of interest. Very physical, very tactical.
Yeah, I remember running a 4th edition D&D Dark Sun campaign with the official Dark Sun 4E books. And that book came with a map that you could lay out on the table. And it was not a hex map, but it was, you know, to scale. There was a mile chart on it. But really just whenever they needed to travel from one place to another, just throwing that map on the table and everyone sort of gathering around it like Napoleon in his tent and all of Napoleon's advisors, right? It brings a feeling of verisimilitude and tactileness and immersion, maybe, to the experience of just looking down and being like, where are we going? Where do we want to go? Why are we going there?
Right, yeah. I think my favorite application or deployment of a hex map is when it's both a player aid and an artifact at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
You know, obviously player aids are great. And I, frankly, having played now lots of like Mothership in the last couple of weeks, I realized that I want more player aids than any GM will ever be willing to give me.
Yeah.
And that's partly because, like, you know, when you're playing a sci-fi game that's all about problem solving, you want to ask a lot of science questions if you're a giant nerd like me. You know, but when I'm playing like a fantasy game, you know, it's like I want the player aid, but if it's going to be on the table, it would be cool if it does have that component of like, oh, we're all standing around it just like our characters would be, and we're looking at a map. I think this is a thing that I've seen done in a lot of video games, not necessarily in board games or RPGs, but like you give the player the map when their character gets the map.
Yeah.
That's like a classic, you know, Zelda thing probably would probably be like the most immediate like touchstone. But I love having that element brought in because then you can also do a lot of other stuff with that map then too, where you can withhold information on the map.
Yeah,
and the players get to change it as well. And I think that goes back to the modularity thing is like the modularity goes both ways for both sides of the table. The GM, it's great for prep, but then also like it gives the players a means to interact with it in really easy, bite-sized little ways. Like it's got every single hex is a little morsel that they can digest one at a time. which goes back to that whole like numbers thing of like you don't want to give them too much because, oh, here I go again. UX design Hick's law basically says that like the time to make a decision increases the more options and complex options there are. So, and you want to keep that number pretty low, I think, in an RPG. You want the players to be ponderous about a decision because it's important, not because there's lots of them and they can't quite process what to do.
Yeah, I mean, as a podcast coming out of the Blades in the Dark world, like this is what flashbacks in that game were created for. Like, okay, how are we going to like elaborately plan our whole heist? No, just like, you know, we don't want to sit around making that kind of choice forever unless it's interesting.
Yeah, I love that game. The funny thing about Blades in the Dark is I really like the flashback, but I don't hear as many people talking about the load rules.
Oh, yeah.
Which do the same thing to me.
So smart, yeah.
Like, we're not going to waste any part of our playtime on something that's not actually going to come up.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that's also kind of nice about, I guess, a hex map in a way is, like, some of the components, all the components are there and can be used right then and there.
Yep.
There are other like maps where you might play with them and it's like you can't tell if it's important to be there or not. Like if you look at an old or even a new Dungeons and Dragons map, it will have like no grid and it'll just be like really pretty trees and forests drawn. Mm-hmm. And unless the GM tells you, hey, there you can go there, then the players are like looking at the only things that matter, which has been proven by canon, is only Waterdeep, Baldur's Gate, Candlekeep, and Neverwinter. And you just zigzag between those places. Yeah. That's about it. But if that map were more of a hex map, then suddenly, at the very least, you now know, oh, wait, actually, that forest, which is a nothing forest originally, I now know that it is at least 6 adventuring locations because it's 6 different hexes. And then suddenly, the GM, again, going back to their prep, they can start inserting things into those hexes. And now the players have a vector for exploration.
Yeah, the world feels more alive.
Yeah, I have this problem in my games, or I did have this problem, getting better at it. But I would like make this world, you know, I had the little mind worm that said you had to like make a whole world before you could play. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I would make this world and then I would be confused as to why my players didn't immediately say where they wanted to go.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's like they need fewer options and the options need to be concrete. And I think a hex map would have been part of that. You know, like you give them a couple like distant locations on the map where it's like that hex is really important. But right now, you don't have to worry about that. All you have to worry about is the 3 sides of your hex that'll get you towards that hex.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, there they go. They got the thrust, the momentum in one direction. And then making the decision is so much easier.
The other thing I really like about modularity is how it allows starting a campaign that's going to use a hex map to really start with just like 3 hexes. There's a famous OSRE blog post about just 3 hexes. That's all you need to start your campaign. But I mean, really, you know, even a small amount of like 7 hexes, one with a ring around it, or 21, which is 1 hex with sort of 2 layers around it, that's something that's going to take you an afternoon, maybe 2 afternoons to like create as a GM, but that's really not a huge amount of work and gives you just plenty to start with and then such an easy way to expand from there too. So if you're someone who is interested in trying out the hex crawl thing, like running a game like this or whatever, the hex itself makes it a lot easier to get your feet wet, to set things up, and to start off trying to do that.
Yeah, and first off, if you prep like just 3 hexes, that's an entire session, if not 2 sessions right then and there.
Yeah.
If you're doing the whole like 20 hexes to make like a small map, kind of like what you have in Monster, that's a campaign. You know, it's a lot of room to explore in that. And this is a completely different thing, but like, you know, I've been thinking about, have you read The Adventure by Luke Gearing, The Isle, at all?
I have read several pages of The Isle, and I think it looks amazing. I've listened to the Between Two Cairns podcast episode about The Isle. Excellent. I have not read it all the way through myself.
Well, I've been thinking about that, and I think Chris Bissett has also said there's like this component of that game or that adventure where there are just empty rooms.
Yeah. And
this is like a thing that is kind of controversial, but it comes from like two different philosophies. And I'm wondering about, like, if you make a hex map, you get to decide, is every single one of these hexes going to have a thing inside of it?
Yeah.
Because if you're playing like Mouse Ritter, they only give you like a whole world map. It's only like 9 hexes, and every single hex is like an adventuring location. It's like big. But if you play a more classic OSR or old school game of some sort, there are hexes where literally like your GM will roll a die to see if something happens. And if nothing happens, nothing happens. You just keep moving. Yeah. And so there's a lot of empty space. But Chris Bissett and Luke Gehring, I believe they both said that, like, done correctly, that can create tension and a sense of verisimilitude in the space. So in like the aisle, you know, you may walk into empty rooms, but you're always going to hear something like just deeper in. And the more you go in to other rooms, the louder the noise gets.
And it builds tension so well. Not just, I mean, you can hear it in the way you're describing that already, but even in overland travel, the idea that, yeah, okay, it's going to take 6 hexes to get from here to the castle. Okay, well, let's roll for the first random encounter. Let's roll for the second random encounter. Like, that sort of building of tension is fun and exciting.
Yeah, and there's an element of, like, every experience with RPGs is, like, partly felt in post. Like, the story does not stick together until a week later when you're thinking back on the story and you've shaved off the edges of all the, like, empty space. You've edited it, the memory in your mind. And you will remember maybe that you did 6 hexes. So you know it took a long time for your guys to get there. But if there was nothing in it, you as a person is not going to remember what happened in every single individual hex. But the power it imparts on your memory is that it forced your brain to, like, measure the time passing.
Yeah, you are going to remember the building of tension as you made your way towards the castle. And you're going to remember a lot when you got ambushed by a basilisk on the way there.
Yeah, yeah. If we were reading, or if we watched, like, Lord of the Rings or whatever, and all we saw was just Sam and Frodo, and no one else, and they just cut from, like, the 3 locations that we see that they're in the books, we'd think that Middle Earth was tiny, that the trip was not that hard, or it wasn't that long. But because we see lots of footage of them just walking, and then we will spend 30 minutes to an hour with a completely different, like, group of characters who have entire sieges, wars, adventures without them, that creates the truth that they have been traveling for a really long time.
Yeah, yeah.
And if we remove those brief moments where we just see them walking through the marshes for a long time, we lose a little bit of that. Which, of course, maybe for some games doesn't matter. Again, going back to if you're playing Monster Hearts or whatever, being in a sedan and talking about the mile markers is not going to be interesting. And it's not going to give you anything useful.
But unless you create some other kind of mechanic for it. You know, the hex is not the only kind of mechanic that's going to make that interesting, but the hex is a mechanic that does make that interesting.
Yeah, it does. And it's really easy to use, which is why it's still being used in games even now.
Yeah.
In fact, it's being used right now in Wolves on the Coast by Luke Gehring, which is one of the other things that's cool about the hex is that it's a really good way for writers to just be told that they have to write like 3 different passages. And so if you're a really good writer, a hex map is a table of contents. You have to write something for every single chapter. Every hex can be a chapter. And you get to decide the pacing, the rise and fall, the climax. And so if you wanted to, you could almost take a hex map, and obviously drawing a map is fun all in and of itself. But you could also create almost like a heat map of excitement and like tension on the map itself just by mapping it. Like, there's a lot of games like Symbol Realm is like this, where getting deeper into the Forbidden Forest is bad. It's going to be more dangerous. And so if you were to completely remove all the qualities of the hex map, but you kept like the danger, like as a danger meter on the map, you would see that the hex map is this concentric circles of bad stuff, layers. It has layers.
You want to talk about hex flowers?
So hex flowers are, it's this slightly newer thing. It came out of a blog. The blog's name, I can't remember.
I looked this up later, and it appears to be the Goblin's Henchman blog. There's a link in the show notes.
But we talked earlier about how, like, maps weren't always literal interpretations of the thing that they're depicting. A hex flower is the same way. It's not a literal, like, this is the boundaries of a map. It's a random number generator. And so the way the hex flower works is that you start in the central hex of like a 20 hex grid that forms a bigger hex.
Yeah.
And that poses the characters with six possible results, right? And then you roll dice, and every hex flower is a little bit different. You can change the way it behaves based off of how you randomize the numbers. But you roll dice, and then the dice will tell you where in the hex the players progress to. And so what you get is this random table that has like an internal logic or memory built into it. Because the next number that you roll is dependent upon where you are now and where you've been in the past.
So the easiest example of this that I've seen is like a random weather chart where you know, weather is something where yesterday's weather probably is related or correlates to some extent with today's weather. So you have like, you know, really stormy weather at the top of the hex and really sunny weather at the bottom of the hex. And you'll start in the middle. And like, if you're headed towards sunny stuff, probably tomorrow will be sunny too. But eventually variance will bring you up towards the top again, and then it'll start raining and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and the numbers that you're rolling will have a bias. So like the designer who's making the hex flower can decide like, oh, you know, I'm going to have them roll 2d6s. And but with that number, then I know that the hex flower is going to force players. It's going to sort of weigh them towards like the bottom of the
hex
flower. And so when that happens, then you can be like, well, I want this kind of event to happen more often than this kind of event. So you put the really like rare thing up at the top of the flower where only crazy wild rolls are going to get them there. And then the things that are more rote or expected will show up in the ones where the bell curve sends them to more often than not.
Yeah. So the hex flower is like a cool way to do a random table. And it acts as sort of like a metaphorical map too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really cool. The idea that you can be moving around like a metaphorical space instead of a physical space. I don't know how like broadly applicable that is, but it is a really neat idea that I'm sure could be applied more often than I see it applied.
Yeah, it does this thing where like normally random tables don't have a sense of progress.
Yeah.
To them. Like different things will sort of proc, so to speak, on the table, but rarely do you get this sensation of movement. So even if the hex flower is metaphorical, which it normally is, you still get the feeling that you've been moving, like that progress is being made.
Yes.
And you're going to know this because you're a writer. theory of composition, I think, is the word. It's the idea of like if you're writing like a short story or something, every word sentence should work towards the goal or like the core theme of the story. I love this in design as well. It's the same way with like graphic design. If you're going to make like a logo, the colors, the angles, everything should be going towards like the overall theme or concept.
Yeah.
And if you were making an RPG where everything about it is about travel or movement, then this would be like one way that you could do that, right? Like, because you could just do a random table, but a hex flower, if it does impart this sensation of movement or progress, and that's what your game is about, then maybe you should use the hex flower because it could just be another component that is borrowing or reinforcing this core idea or concept of your game.
Yeah, totally. All right. We've been going for quite a while, so I think it's time to wrap this up. So I just want to say one last thing, though, which is that fundamentally, I think drawing maps is fun and hexes make drawing maps easier. And therefore, I'm pro hexagon.
I was praying at the altar of hexagons well before I started making maps, but now I've just become this like foaming at the mouth zealot about them. drawing maps is...
I'm putting that in your intro. Foaming at the mouth hexagon zealot.
Yeah.
Clayton.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you being here. This was really fun. Thanks for coming out.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Clayton for being here, and see you tomorrow for part two of this season premiere with Morgan Nuncio and I talking about travel from the story game side. Clayton can be found at Clayton Notestein on Twitter, at Explorers Design on Blue Sky and Dice.camp, at explorers.itch.io, and of course at explorersdesign.com. That's also where you can get his sick layout templates and join the Explorers Design Discord. I'll see you in there. You can also join the Dice Exploder Discord. Why not? Come and talk about the show, if you want to. As always, you can find me on Blue Sky, Twitter, Dice.camp, and Itch at S. Dunnewald. Our logo was designed by Sporgory, and our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. And as always, thanks to you for listening. See you tomorrow!